So it will only briefly touch quantum gravity, but it will mostly be about cosmology and aspects of quantum theory that are important for structure formation. And so the idea in structure formation is to explain how the complicated state of the universe that we observe now with lots of structure can have emerged out of a very simple initial state. And there's one possibility, we can just put it into initial conditions, but that wouldn't be very satisfactory. So the idea is to start with a simple state, a vacuum state for matter fields, and then see if the structure as we observe it can grow out of it just by cosmological evolution and gravitational attraction. So that's at least the idea in inflationary structure formation. So one has matter fields or the inflaton field. And even if it starts in a vacuum state, there are quantum fluctuations. So this is supposed to give the initial seeds for all the structure that we see then, which is initially just growing not very rapidly, but then at some point gravitational attraction will become important and to see more structure. But the initial seeds for that are really all in these quantum fluctuations. That's at least the idea, and it's working quite well, as you all know, so one can compute what kind of structure one would expect from that, compare that with observations of anisotropies and microwave background, and that is agreeing quite well. So these are not the most recent data, but this is already giving an idea of the amount by which that idea is really working. So this is the rough picture, but there are certainly, as usually, also problems. One of them is that these quantum fluctuations are really quantum, but then what we observe in the end are classical inhomogeneities. So somehow these quantum fluctuations have to become classical, or at least have to interact with the classical quantities. And the initial classical state is really homogeneous, so we just assume here that it's an aperture isotropic model initially, and there are these quantum fluctuations, but then some of these quantum fluctuations have to back react on classical inhomogeneities, and the precise relation for that is not very easy to find. So what inflation usually does is just this assumption here. So phi k are the classical inhomogeneities for the inflaton field, and they are just identified with the square root of quantum fluctuations. And so that is the thing that's working. So if one does that, one gets more or less quite a close agreement with observations. But that's not really what we usually do in quantum theory. So usually the classical objects are identified with expectation values of the operators. That would be the expectation value of phi k itself, but that's zero initially if we assume that the field starts in a vacuum state where the modes are just unexcited. So that clearly would not work. That would not give any homogeneity. Then the universe would always remain as homogeneous as the initial state. But if one makes this assumption, then one gets these inhomogeneities at a scale dependence which agrees with observations. So this is important for the picture, but there's no conceptual justification for that provided in inflation. It's also related to more observational issues. And first of all, the amplitude of these anisotropies of one computes it in this framework of structural formation is too large for several orders of magnitude, though that's not always mentioned, but if we compare with these anisotropy spectra as before, then the scale dependence comes out quite precisely. But unless one fine-tunes the models quite severely, there's this disagreement, I think it's about six orders of magnitude usually, between the predicted amplitude of anisotropies, which would be higher than the expected, and the observed amplitude. So this seems that the correct identification should really be something in between. So this identification here gives us an amplitude which is too large. This identification would give us zero. That would clearly be too small. So there should be something in between. And this has to be found out by finding a more detailed picture of these interactions that are just put in by assumption here. And then there's a second point related to observations, which is the suppression of power on large scales. So that's just an enlargement of the plot I showed before on large scales. And this may be a problem, and in particular the fact that if one looks at this more precisely, as some people get it, then one can observe that this is really a suppression only of odd modes and not of even modes. And this is also something which is not coming out of the usual assumptions behind this structural relation. So this is the second point related to observational problems. And then finally, which I just mentioned here briefly, so I'm not going to talk about this much today. So a picture is also conceptually not complete because it's based on general relativity. So all these models start out with a singular initial state, the usual singularities of general relativity. And one needs something like quantum gravity, possibly, to solve singularity problems. And if one does well, then there can also be other modifications to all the universe evolution, which also have to be derived from structure theory. But as I said, that's not the point I'm focusing on now. I'm mainly discussing this issue here. So how can it happen that quantum fluctuations really play a role for the evolution of classical perturbations, and what does it imply for these issues related to observations? And that's all contained in the matter anatomy. So we have an inflaton field on an involving background. So we need to take that scalar anatomy for a scalar phi, and it's written here in canonical form. So p phi is the momentum of the scalar. And this describes the coupling of this inflaton field to the macro background, which is contained in this quantity q here. So that's the spatial metric. Usually one just assumes the potential to be of this form quadratic for a massive scalar. So if it would be just on a flat background, that would be a free field theory, and it would be easy to quantize. But that's not really the case here, because there are these factors of q, and now q, spatial metric, is also dynamical. And the coupling terms, all these terms are coupling terms between the metric and the inflaton field. So it's really an interacting field theory between gravity encoded by the scalar, by the spatial metric component q, and the macro field encoded by the inflaton. So one is really dealing with an interacting quantum field theory here, also including gravity. So the full picture would clearly involve quantum gravity, but that's not required for all issues, fortunately, because that would be quite complicated. And then if we just take this Hamiltonian, then there are two main implications. The first one is that there is really a role of quantum fluctuations, because now if we quantize this object, all these bright things will become operators. So in particular, there's a term which is of the form phi squared here, and also in the potential limits of that form, that is p phi squared. And this will be operators squared if we quantize. So that really gives us fluctuation terms if we compare that just with the expectation value squared. So fluctuations clearly play a role in the Hamiltonian. The question is only what that role exactly is. So we need to take the expectation value to see these fluctuation terms. And so what we have to see is how the expectation value of the Hamiltonian determines these cosmological perturbation equations that could be relevant for coupling metric modes to the matter modes. But if that is accepted, and I will explain this in the main part of this talk, then we can see that if we just replace these phi squared here by something like this, then fluctuation terms will also multiply metric components. So there will be coupling terms between metric and fluctuations. And then if we just use this as a Hamiltonian, as usually computing equations of motion that it generates, then there will be coupling terms between metric and fluctuations and equations of motion. So that will give us a clear possibility to see how these quantum fluctuations that we assume initially see the classical structure that we observe. That's the first implication. Second one again, just to mention it here, is that we really have to quantize also these Q factors, which are like part of the metric. It's also dynamic equilibrium freedom, so that's a part of the quantum gravity, and where additional corrections can come in on smaller scales. So,
this is a mini superspace picture where it's just the scale factor being quantized?
No, it's not supposed to be. Well, I'm assuming at this formula that we have just diagonal components, but they can also be position dependent. So it's it would be relevant for the scalar mode metric derivations.
Okay, well, the tensor modes and things are just.
Right, but that's just for simplicity, that can also be included. And in the end, if we really do these quantum gravity calculations, usually we start with mini superspace models and then try to include homogeneities by some means. But since I'm not going to talk about this much anyway, I don't need to worry about this here. And the first point,
you could imagine that in the quantum classical transition, though, the trace over those things you're not following could be relevant, right?
Well, for the transition, I'm not assuming mini superspace. That's really at the homogeneous level. So in that case, we just take into account these fluctuation terms of the matter, but Q will remain classical. And this will be simpler. And in particular, one can do that by effective theory without having too many complications by even quantum keeping on curve backgrounds, which would be quite complicated. So so that is a generalization of low energy effective action. So usually one uses this quite heavily in particle physics, where one can derive low energy effective actions by curving around the vacuum state of a theory in a flat background. But this is not possible to do for our purposes because we just don't know what the appropriate vacuum state would be. Here we also include these couplings to gravity, so the vacuum state, if we wanted to specify, would also have to involve the gravitational degree of freedom. That would require quantum gravity. So the Euler techniques cannot be applied here, but there's a more general formalism by which one can derive effective equations, and which reduces to the usual energy effective actions in the regime where we're really doing perturbations along the vacuum state. And this more general formalism, which I'm going to describe now, is what we're going to use here. And this will allow us to see how these fluctuation terms appear. So and this will tell us why really the expectation value of the Hamiltonian operator is relevant and why the quantum fluctuations that then occur there also play a role in equations of motion. Now, the derivation of effective actions or effective equations is usually quite technical. So what's done for low energy effective action is one either computes it perturbatively by computing Feynman diagrams, or one starts with the generating function of endpoint functions and does some Hilbert transformation to arrive at an effective action. And the picture that we use here is quite different. So it's based on a geometrical formulation of quantum mechanics, which means that we don't use the Hilbert space formalism, but we just view the Hilbert space as an infinite dimensional phase space, which is always possible, where the Poisson brackets just come from the imaginary part of the inner product. So one can check by the usual property that this has satisfies all the relations that one needs for a Poisson bracket. And the advantage is that this formulation is much closer to what we have for classical systems. So classical mechanics is also based on a phase space. It's just finite dimensional in quantum mechanics. While in classical mechanics, right, quantum mechanics would be based on an infinite dimensional phase space. But since here the formalism is much closer than in the usual description by Hilbert spaces, one can make a better relation between these two frameworks, and in particular, derive these effective equations, which are just like classical equations, except that there are also correction terms coming from quantum effects. And that's possible in this formalism, so not just the Poisson brackets, but also dynamics will be similar. And this allows this generalization. So here's an expression for these Poisson brackets. So our phase space is now the Hilbert space, so points are states, and we can choose coordinates on that space by expanding these states in an arbitrary basis that we choose. and take these expansion coefficients as coordinates on that space. And then we can check that by this definition, through the inner product, really an imaginary part of these coefficients are canonically conjugate. So we have these Poisson brackets and 1/2H4 just appears for normalization.
Are you assuming this commonly infinite there? Or I mean, could you imagine C, or I mean, is J necessarily a discrete pair?
Yeah, right. Right now, I'm basically assuming that. So, and in particular, it should be a separable Hilbert space. And one can also make it more general, but in a moment, I will introduce different coordinates to try and make better suited to these effective things. So, that's just to show how you get these structures. So, that's the kinematical setup. So, we got these Poisson brackets. So, that is what usually Q and P position and momentum would satisfy in classical mechanics. And now also dynamics has a very similar form. So usually dynamics is given by the Schrödinger equation for these states. And now that's a point where really the expectation value of the Hamiltonian comes in that we already used in some way in this cosmology example. So if we define this expectation value just as a quantum Hamiltonian, then this would also be a function of these expansion coefficients or whatever coordinates we use in our Hilbert space or phase space. And now we can compute this, of course, if we know how the Hamiltonian acts on the basis that we chose to define these coordinates. That's particularly simple if we just choose this to be the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Then the quantum Hamiltonian has this form with energy eigenvalues Ej. And now we can use the Poisson bracket we had before and this quantum Hamiltonian and just compute Hamiltonian brackets of motion that we would do. So the time derivative of any coordinate is just given by the Poisson bracket with the quantum Hamiltonian, where we got this result here. Or if we just write it as a complex equation for Cj, we get this equation, which is identical to the Schrödinger equation that we would have for expansion coefficients in an eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. So that shows that this the usual Schrödinger dynamics can be formulated equivalently as Hamiltonian dynamics on this infinite dimensional phase space generated by the quantum Hamiltonian, which is simply the expectation value of the Hamiltonian operator. So also here, the description is identical to that in classical mechanics, such that it's on an infinite dimensional phase, the phase space. I should say that there are also differences. So if we want to know what observables are, for instance, then there are then not any function on that infinite dimensional phase space is an observable. And this would be the classical case. So that's a difference, but as far as dynamics is concerned, there's no difference between the formalism. And as I indicated earlier, this is what allows us to find these effective equations because we are much closer in the formulation now between classical and quantum mechanics. And the only thing one needs to do is really to find approximations to cut down these infinitely many variables to finitely many ones. And once we do that, we can speak of an effective system which describes the quantum system by finitely many classical equations of the classical type, so just some couple of differential equations that approximate the quantum dynamics. So that's the main point left to do. One has to find suitable approximations, in particular if you want to reproduce these low-energy effective action results. And to do that, I introduced these new variables. So these are also much more suited to the to make contact with the classical formulation. There are two obvious coordinates that we can choose, just expectation values of our basic operators. And these would be what we would understand as classical variables. So we just take the expectation value of Q and P in quantum mechanics. These are also functions on our phase space now. We can use them as coordinates. But they are just two, so we need infinitely many ones, and the rest can be written in this form. So we take expectation values of powers of Q and P and products of Q and P, and then one can check that that's sufficient to span the whole phase space, not even overcomplete, but anywhere these variables are better for calculations. So these classical variables together with quantum variables are now our set of coordinates in the phase space. And as before, they also satisfy equations of motion, they are all dynamical. And to compute these equations, we need to know, as before, the Poisson relations between them. So between Q and P, it's simple, that's just as in the classical case, so that Poisson bracket is 1. And the bracket between Q and P and any of the quantum variables is 0, so that's really kinematically independent. And then there are brackets between these quantum variables, which are more complicated. It also has been computed explicitly, so you can find it in these papers, and it would be too long to quickly use it here. So one can use that for calculations and in particular compute these equations. So we get dynamical equations for all these variables. And what this means intuitively is that we have a weight bracket describing the state. But now we describe it by these coordinates. So we have a peak of the wave packet, which is given by these classical studies. But then it's part of the there's more information in these quantum variables. So also the spread of the wave packet and other deformations play a role. They also change generally during evolution, so they also have their equations of motion, which tell us how they change. And most importantly, there's also back reaction. So the way these spreads and deformations change in time also has implications for the way of these classical variables behave. So they determine also the position of the peak. And all this interaction is contained in these effective equations. First, of course, driven by the quantum dynamics, because that's still a description of the quantum system. So we still have Schrödinger equation or quantum Hamiltonian, which describes the dynamics, which couples all these classical and quantum variables. And so in particular, we can compute this. Here's an example for an anharmonic oscillator of this form. So that's the situation in which we can reproduce the low energy effective action, because the harmonic oscillator itself, if Q is zero, would correspond to a free theory. And if we allow some perturbations in that potential, which are not quadratic, then we're doing a perturbation around that free field theory. So that is a way to check if we really get the correct low energy effective action that they usually derive in that limit. And so that we can do. So we have this classical Hamiltonian that would be quantized. So we would just use operators instead of these classical variables. And then we compute the expectation value, because that's not just linear. So there are quadratic components and even higher powers in the potential. We will see all these quantum variables in the expectation value of that Hamiltonian, because P squared, or the expectation value of P squared, is not identical to the expectation value of P of delta A in the square. So there are additional quantum variable terms, and I'm going to write this down in these dimensionless variables. So we use this H bar anyway, and also M and omega that we have in this case, to make these variables dimensionless. Then we got this Hamiltonian. So by definition, we compute the expectation value of the operator. We just write it in this way. It's just an identity. But now we treat this Q operator minus Q formally as a small quantity and expand. And if we do this, we obtain the leading order of the classical Hamiltonian, as we should. Then there's a term for first order in H bar, which just contains quantum variables, which doesn't couple classical and quantum variables, which just plays a role here of zero point energy. But then if we have a non-trivial potential here, then there are coupling terms between classical variables and these quantum variables, because there are higher powers here that we need to expand. And just by Taylor expansion of the potential, we got these derivatives, the nth derivative of the potential, which still depends on Q, is multiplied with the quantum variable of order n. So that is a new coupling term in this Hamiltonian, which is not contained in the classical Hamiltonian, so it goes to zero if H bar goes to zero.
Can I ask a quick question? When we do coherent states, we know that we get a semi-classical description, and the next things are suppressed by fluctuations.
Yeah.
In this picture also, it's easy to see that this is the real classical piece. And
yeah, and these dimensionless variables, I mean, of course, we still have to find out what the magnitude of this d-tilde is. But just by dimensional argument, that is, these terms are positive powers of h bar. And you have to solve equations for d-tilde to see if they are not large. But these effective equations will be, in fact, an adiabatic approximation for the Feynman variables. But they will remain small if they start small initially just by some limited by uncertainties. And
the definitions of the G's actually don't depend on your description, right? Because they're just values of fluctuations. They could be evaluated in any picture.
Yes. Right. It's just fitting coordinates on the page.
There's no operator over any ambiguities?
Yeah, there is. Also in these quantum variables, I always assume by the ordering. And in that case, we don't really have an operator ordering problem because U is supposed to be dependent on
Q.
But you're right, for the cosmological anatomy I showed, you can have this. And on this H bar also brings me to the next remark, just as a side remark here. These corrections really come as fractional powers of H bar. So usually one assumes that corrections only come in H bar powers. But it's starting at order 3 by 2. So that's a fractional power, unless the potential is even. So usually one assumes even potentials for stability reasons, but they're also more complicated problems. In particular in gravity, when there's no such requirement. And in that case, one can easily get corrections in fractional powers of H bar, which also plays a role for quantum gravity, because in four dimensions, at least, a function is proportional to the square root of H bar. And sometimes it's puzzling to have corrections in all integer forms of the Planck length, because that would mean fraction powers of h bar. And this shows that even in quantum mechanics, we usually get corrections in fraction powers of h bar. So it's not something that is just relevant for quantum gravity. But what we never have is the order at 1 by 2, which would be even smaller than zero point energy, because these quantum variables only start at n equals 2. So that is the n equals 2 term. These are here, these higher n terms. And there's no term which is just a square root of h bar. So that's the smallest fractional term would be h bar to the 3 by 2. So this is the Hamiltonian we're going to use now. So we have the classical part, some zero point energy, which will not be very relevant here. And then all these coupling terms between classical and quantum variables. And so then we use these Poisson relations that I showed earlier to compute equations of motion. And they are this form. So the Q dot equation doesn't change. The P dot equation, that's because the potential only depends on Q and not on P. The P dot equation gets an additional term, or a whole series of additional terms containing these couplings between classical and quantum variables. And then the quantum variables themselves satisfy quite complicated equations that I don't write down completely here. But this shows that this is now a set of infinitely many equations for infinitely many variables. They are coupled to each other. So that's complicated to solve. It's only uncoupled if we have the harmonic oscillator. So if the potential is zero, then at each order n, only variables at the same order are involved on the right hand side. But that's a harmonic oscillator that we know how to solve anyway. As long as there's any non-trivial potential, there are these coupling terms, so all these equations are coupled. And well, this is still equivalent to the full quantum dynamics, so equivalent to the Schrödinger equation. And what we need to do for the effective equations then is to find a suitable approximation which allows us to truncate this set of infinitely many equations to a set of just finitely many ones. And when we do that, we can solve that more easily and also describe our quantum system effectively by a classical system. And that's where we use the adiabatic approximation. So that's similar to the to a derivative expansion that one would do in usually in deriving low energy effective action. So we assume the quantum variables to be evolving only slowly, while Q and P can evolve quite rapidly. And that means that we can ignore some of the time derivatives of these quantum variables and simplify our equations. In particular, we can solve these equations order by order, so that also gives us a way to do a perturbation analysis in H bar, as well as these adiabatic approximation. Here's a result that we get the first order in H bar and second order in the adiabatic approximation. So we get the second order differential equation for Q. All these couplings between Q and the quantum variables have been removed by solving for quantum variables in this approximation, and then reinserting into the plane of motion that we have for Q and P, then we write it as a second order differential equation. So there are these correction terms leading order in H bar. So it also shows that if H bar goes to zero, we just get the classical equations of motion. And one can also check that these equations agree with the equation that one gets by applying the usual low energy effective action techniques. So that shows that in this case, where we are in the same regime, we are in both cases expanding around the free theory or around the harmonic oscillator. In both cases, we have the same equations. So this more general technique here that we use based on these geometrical reformulations gives us the same result, but it's more general because we don't need to make so many assumptions about vacuum states, or we can also do different approximations, but this is just one of them. In particular, that's applicable to cosmology, so we can now come back to this scalar field Hamiltonian that I showed earlier and apply this effective formalism for this Hamiltonian. So now it's much more complicated. It's a field theory, so even classically there are infinitely many degrees of freedom. But again, one can try to find approximations in which one can ignore at least some of these new quantum variables. But it's clear that this quantum Hamiltonian is now given by the expectation value of that object. So everything that is needs to be quantized, which is Q here, the metric components, and the inflaton components are quantized, so they become operators. And then we take the expectation values of all these products that we have in the terms, which give us couplings. So as before, whenever we have products between these operators, we get entropic terms. And since we need to expand the expectation value of a product of operators, we get these fluctuation terms. So for instance, here in this phi squared term, we get not just the classical phi squared, but also a quantum fluctuation term from the inflow. And as before, we compute these Poisson brackets. So technically, we do that by a mode decomposition, and then each mode of the field can be formulated in the same way as before. So we get Poisson brackets, or first quantum variables for each node independently, and then Poisson brackets between all these variables. That's a Hamiltonian we use, so we compute our equations of motion in the Hamiltonian way, and then look at these equations and see what that implies for structure formation, because then we will really have these fluctuation terms in the equations. We can see how they enter, so whenever they are non-zero, how they influence the evolution of classical inhomogeneities. And here's one example, so that's just the kinetic part, the term which is quadratic in P5. If we expand this, I just write the most important terms here. There's one term, the whole first line is what we have classically anyway. So we have this term between, which couples these modes, k and minus k for the momentum. Then we have a more interesting term for inhomogeneities, which couples metric modes. So these coefficients in a Fourier expansion of the metric components to the modes of the momentum. So this will be one of the terms that gives us the metric contribution to cosmological perturbation equations, just the classical part. But then here these terms are the additional contribution that we get if we compute the expectation value of the operator. So instead of having just the square of the product of these two momentum modes, we have also quantum variables, fluctuation terms that are defined in a way similar to the quantum mechanical case. So we just have to insert operators for different weight numbers here. But otherwise, the definition is similar. So we also have the expectation value here of the product of two p-phi operators. One of them evaluated at k and the other at k prime. And from the Hamiltonian, it follows that this multiplies a metric component u or n here of this form, in particular coupling these fluctuations to these metric components. And most interesting terms are those which have to be non-zero by quantum uncertainty relation. That's the case whenever k equals k prime. Then we have uncertainty relations. So this 2-2 refers to two momentum variables. And the usual Heisenberg relations can be rewritten in this form. So we have this g02, which has a pi squared, and this g22, which has a p pi squared. That is bounded below by h bar, and this correlation term, which is the expectation value of pi and p pi. So whenever the wave numbers agree in these terms, these variables are restricted by uncertainty, so they have to be non-zero in particular, and give us these uncertainty or quantum fluctuation contributions to the evolution equations. And the main term for us from the kinetic part of these is this one. So we have this metric component here multiplying the fluctuation. And if we compute the energy density in the Hamiltonian way, then one can see that it's given by that derivative. So the k-mode of energy density is given by the derivative of the Hamiltonian by the minus k-mode of that function. So whenever we have such a term, it will contribute to energy density. And energy density couples to these cosmological perturbation equations. So in particular, there's a term like this, which is restricted by uncertainty relations and which will appear in these evolution equations. So if we go through the whole procedure, we get these equations. So the left-hand side is just what we have classically as perturbation equations for metric modes. And one last question.
Yeah, about it.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
How do you perform the Fourier decomposition?
I mean, oh, it's on a background. I assume a flat background. And,
so you assume a flat background, so it's not the general Q of quantization?
No, it's not a general quantization. So because we're not quantizing the background of the metric here anyway, but we do this as perturbation equations and just linear, so we.
So, but in what sense is then what you, on the previous slide, you had the metric, somewhere you had metric fluctuation coupling, so it's not a quantized metric, right?
Right, yeah, these terms, for instance, couple these fluctuations in G2 metric components. But here I just focus on quantum effect in the metal part. So that's
but what's the difference that quantizing on Minkowski space, a scale of the Minkowski space?
Oh, then you wouldn't have these coupling terms. I mean, then Q would just be a constant, and it would not be dynamic. So whatever you have, you just have linear contributions to the Hamiltonian.
So you quantize the metric?
No, not at this stage.
Sorry?
Not at this stage. I mean, it's one could really quantize the metric before computing the expectation values. But and this is contained in these dots. So there would be additional terms where you have correlations between the metric modes when you quantize them and metric modes, which I ignore here because I don't consider quantum gravity. But anyway, whatever this term gives us, there will be a contribution like this if we just have the metric mode classically, and but include quantum fluctuation terms and other correlations for the metric modes.
So is there a difference between this and some Lukanov-style perturbation theory?
Well, in that case, you wouldn't have these terms, right? In that case, you would just have the first one. So that's why you have to make this assumption, usually, that classical inhomogeneities are directly related to square roots of fluctuations.
Sorry, can you on that point? You mentioned that at the beginning. That people right. Say that the fluctuation improving the expectation value of the square of the operator.
Yeah.
I mean, to my knowledge, that's a very old-fashioned way of
doing it, which some old papers and books use. I mean, these days, perturbation theory, the inflaton fluctuation, is linearly related to the curvature perturbation.
Yeah, but
the quantum state gives you a probability distribution for the inflaton field. And the spread of that distribution is related to your the correlation function that you measure on the sky. And the value, I mean, the classical value of the inflaton field that you see is not thought to be the square root of this thing. It's thought to be just one of the elements picked out of the probability distribution.
Right.
And one can ask, you know, how does a quantum superposition become classical? I mean, you can ask that about any quantum experiment. But, so I mean, I don't know how important this is for you, but it seems to me that this point you're making is something that the current literature just doesn't use. I mean, it's in Padmanabhan's book, you know, and so on, some very old paper.
I mean, the question is
that anymore.
Well, maybe not in the same way, but I think, and if you read Padmanabhan's recent papers, for instance, you find this
remark.
Padmanabhan's recent papers.
Padmanabhan.
So, people are still saying it's
some people. Can I make a suggestion as chair? Can we distinguish between clarifying what Martin is doing and questions of the form of why are you doing this or why aren't you doing that, something like that, which we can say for a lively discussion. So is it clear what Martin is doing? That's because I think you're close to presenting results. So
yeah, I will come back to these issues anyway.
I do have one question about that.
Sure.
So I understand the difference between what you're describing and if I were trying to do a Lupinov style calculation, is that you've truncated out a bunch of modes of the, like, you're focusing on the scalar mode, but you're trying to just doing semi-classical gravity and an inflaton. Things that would be in my loops are in your loops because you've got a truncation around the hilbert space. Is that clear?
Yeah, it's a different effective description, I guess. I mean, you put it semi-classically.
But the thing is, when you say effective, all the things that go with that in my mind are just tied to the adiabatic approximation because there's a systematic approximation which tells me why things I'm ignoring don't contribute to some order. And so the question would be, in the application that you have in mind, is there something which controls it that tells you that things that you're not creating in the loops are not important because they're suppressed by something in the non-adiabatic case?
Yeah, I guess you have to look at the equations, really, which we didn't do in complete detail, but we have the equation of motion for all the modes, so we can clearly see if some of them are suppressed or don't increase so strongly and others. What we are keeping so far is mainly these fluctuation terms that are bounded below anyway by uncertainties, by uncertainty relations. So even if we start with most of them as close to zero as possible, these terms would remain. And they would at least tell us how these initial seeds influence the evolution of inhomogeneities.
But it would be important in the assertion that you're going beyond the adiabatic approximation to know that the control.
Right. And that's in particular important to know how long this approximation is valid. So even initially, if it's valid, if we start close to a vacuum state of the matter fields, then at some point, as we will see, these correlations grow, also correlation terms that correlate most to the background values, for instance. And at some point also they will become important or other terms. But, I mean, it's all contained in these equations, one can check it, or if we just do numerical calculation, one can see much more than just cutting down to these the main ones. So, I mean, there are many questions that can be asked. We didn't look in all these details yet, but it's at least containing the formalism. So, what we have here is these are the classical things, and then, there are two issues, kind of like one of the questions here. One of them is doing calculation, the other one is understanding that conceptually. So, basically, the conceptual things are clearly simpler here because these quantum variables directly appear in these effective equations. So we have the classical ones plus correction terms. And we don't need to know how values are picked out of an initial distribution or how wave functions collapse or whatever one calls it. So that automatically appears here. And also here I'm already cutting down to just some of these variables that we probably think of the dominant ones. So there are these fluctuation terms here where weight numbers are equal, so they all go that are restricted by uncertainty relations. And there are terms which are, in a sense, linear. So all of them are linear terms, but these just couple the matter or infra node to the background node. So they just evolve one factor of a field node. And so that is also a term that one can expect to be dominant compared to others. So these are the only terms that I keep here. This is how the classical perturbation equations change. And then we also have equations for these quantum variables themselves. They just write one particular example. But also all the other ones have similar equations of motion. So that is, again, the set of coupled equations that describes the whole system, classical and quantum variables, that we need to solve, which is complicated to solve, but at least some effects can already be seen just by looking at the structure of these equations. So, first of all, these, even if we assume that the metric starts out completely homogeneously initially, so we assume these phi k to be all zero initially, then from the equations it follows that first of all, these correlations, well, there are these fluctuation terms here, so they're not multiplied by any inhomogeneity, so they're not multiplied by the scale factor or the mass of the interferon field. So even if we assume all classical fluctuations or inhomogeneities to be zero initially, there are these fluctuation terms which must be non-zero. And so the right-hand side is non-zero, and that means that also these inhomogeneities have to grow. So it's not possible for the whole system to remain in a homogeneous and vacuum state all the time because of these coupling terms between natural and metric modes. This tells us how this kind of transition that we need between quantum fluctuation and classical perturbations occurs. It's really because there are these fluctuations. And if we consider that really as a nonlinear system, which it is, so there are these coupling terms, then the fluctuations imply that these metric inhomogeneities have to grow. So that is still just seeded by these quantum fluctuations. But then after some evolution, these metric modes will grow stronger. At some point, they will overwhelm the classical quantum fluctuations. And at such a point, one gets a picture that's more or much closer to the classical one. One can then go back and ignore the quantum fluctuation terms because other terms that are bigger in these equations. And the system is mainly described by just classical equations or as we usually use them. So that's the way this transition appears in this effective description.
So in this picture, you're saying that the classical inhomogeneity in a single realization of the universe is related to the quantum statistics of fluctuations.
It's not, we don't do statistics.
What I want to get to is, well, how do you obtain, what you want is a probability distribution of the classical inhomogeneity. I don't see how you're going to get to that. You seem to be deriving a single definite classical inhomogeneity from this underlying quantum distribution. I mean,
right.
I think there's something wrong here. I mean, usually you have, as I said, a linear relation between the classical perturbation and the quantum fluctuation. And you have a probability distribution of the quantum fluctuation giving you a probability distribution for the curvature perturbation,
right,
which you then relate to observation.
But this,
so I'm confused.
This whole system of equations is a deterministic system, just as the Schrödinger equation is deterministic. And we are describing that system here. So we don't do any collapse of wave function or whatever.
Fair enough, but how are you going to get a problem?
Yes, can I again let me suggest, I think we should come back to that question.
I mean, that's one observation.
And I promise you we'll come back.
Okay.
I have a question concerning this. So you have classical gravity and quantum matter. So what kind of equation do you use to cover that? Like usually people take, let's say, G mu and some tensor equal to the expectation value of T mu. Is that which?
We just do it canonically. So we take the Hamiltonian constraints and add them. And your wild Hamiltonian is what you have motion.
But essentially just tensor. See, it's the Hamiltonian version of exactly what you said.
So this is, okay, yeah. So once the GMU expectation value,
yeah.
And the values of the expectation value are being coded in an infinite number of other variables, and then the whole thing expanded out in an infinite dimensional dynamical system.
Right.
But that's the underlying physics is what you said. So again, we'll come back and discuss that.
Yeah, I think I'm very
close. Just wanted to make a statement, though, is that you're not making a statement that you've gone from a pure nothing state by tracing over some environment.
No, I don't think it's not.
Just following the expectation value of a positive thing that you obtain by averaging in a quantum way over linear.
Yeah, it's really still, it's always the quantum system. We're just trying to approximate the quantum system by a set of effective classical equations, which are close to the usual classical equation. So we're still describing the quantum system. There's no explicit transition by computing probability densities. Right?
But you had, in the beginning, both classical variables and quantum.
I call them classical.
Okay.
I call them classical. It's just a coordinate on the quantum phase space. And I call it classical because it's related to, that's the one, if we go to zeroth order in H bar, these are just the classical variables. But they are still related to states, so they are expectation values of operators in states. So they are also part of the quantum theory. Just if we do the most order truncation, this will be classical.
Yeah, but usually when I teach quantum mechanics, I usually say that the classical results are obtained in a limit from the quantum variables.
Right.
But I don't see that happening.
Yes, you saw it in this example of the unharmonic oscillator. When h bar goes to zero, the Hamiltonian just reduces to the classical Hamiltonian, and it just contains the classical, what I call classical variables, and not the quantum variables. So that's also it's the same. It's in this limit, we reproduce a classical system, and it's also in this cosmological case, we can do it in a similar way. Right. So I'm coming to consequences of that formalism. First of all, one can see when this identification that inflationary models are usually based on is realized. And one of the terms one can look at is this one, for instance, which needs to be equal to the right-hand side for the identification to be exactly satisfied. And then one can check for a regime, so one needs to have small correlations for that to be true. But one also needs to violate uncertainty relations, in particular the second step here, because one identifies the square root of this fluctuation term with the expectation value of the background momentum, and this is one thing where one violates uncertainty relations, so there would be additional correction terms. But otherwise, it can be that one is at least close to that relation. So now to these consequences. First of all, if we take these equations and we start out initially without any classical inhomogeneities, then we have just these fluctuation terms on the right-hand side. And they imply that classical perturbations also grow, so these metric inhomogeneities. But that's a more indirect process than the usual identification. So it is likely, we didn't check that in detail, but it's likely to give a much smaller amplitude, and that's one possibility to check really quantitatively with this equation whether that amplitude gets closer to what is being observed. And these things are quite recent, so we didn't do all these calculations here, but that's pretty possible. Second observation is.
Sorry, just before that, just intuitively, where would you get that to the minus 5? What is the physical origin?
I don't know. I mean, I can only say it's something between zero and 10 to the 5.
So you would need 5 as well.
I don't know. I mean, you have to see what natural initial values for all these quantum variables would be. And how these things on the become. So it probably depends on the prehistory, because this tells you how long this growing process would have been. And
so typically it's like a ratio of 2 scales. I'm just wondering if you can find 2 scales in the world.
Possibly. I mean, 1 scale would be the moment or at which these moves are really at least primordial seems are late. So that is one possibility to choose a scale. And so as I said, we use the big lofty issue. The other one is not just these metric modes, but also correlation terms will be generated. So if we go back to these equations, then the equations for psi k depend on these g k naught variables. If we just look at this equation, we have this g k naught on the right hand side, and the evolution of g k naught depends not just on psi k itself, as the thing that appears on this equation, but it also depends on psi 2k. So these equations don't just couple these classical and quantum variables, they also couple, even though it's still a system, a linear system, and there's no second order perturbation theory, these equations couple metric modes at different wavelengths. So that means that also correlations have to grow here. So that is the second observation. And then the final one is to that point that I mentioned, the suppression of modes. So again, if we go back to these equations, then on the right-hand side for psi k, we have the fluctuation terms, but they depend on k by 2, not on k itself. That's because they're coming out of the quadratic field Hamiltonian. And this means that if we have a compact spatial manifold, something that's closed, then the wave numbers are on a lattice. So it can happen that their wave modes, in particular odd modes, k, for which we could compute a metric perturbation, but for which this quantum fluctuation doesn't exist because simply k by 2 is not on the lattice. So this means that these modes, odd modes, are not seeded in the same way as even modes, because for them there's no such quantum fluctuation. And they are much smaller initially, so there should also be smaller outplay evolution to what we can observe. So that can also, again, still without having done any quantitative tests, be a mechanism to explain that kind of suppression of odd modes without invoking any parity violation mechanism. And,
is that point parity or mirror parity?
I guess it's point parity.
Right, then it's the other way around, actually. So basically, it's the even modes that has
to. All right. Yeah, I guess this will be relevant for these quantitative issues, but because we really have to know what kind of lattice we have. And, what we can say is that, there's this relation between the metric modes and modes in the quantum fluctuations. And there will be some suppression. I mean, then, as first point, one really has to see whether or not in detail and see how that works quantitatively. But anyway, one can use these equations, so that provides a framework. And now I finally come to some quantum gravity issues, just for one slide here. Again, we go back to that Hamiltonian, and now we have to consider how to quantize also these metric components. And this can also get additional terms in these effective equations that are not coming from quantum gravity really, and not just quantum fluctuation effects. In particular, there's an inverse here, and when one quantizes an inverse, then it can happen that there are stronger modifications. For instance, in a theory like group quantum gravity, one has a spatial discreteness realized in a manner such that this Q operator that one would have to use here has a discrete spectrum, that is a spatial discreteness. But there's a zero in the spectrum, and in that case, the inverse operator itself does not exist. And that's the reason why one expects usually correction terms. That's one thing that's realized beyond the loop framework. So here's one example where one has effective inverse powers. So classically, that would just be some inverse power law behavior. I was plotted here on these corrections that one gets from by considering operator that one really has to insert here. So all of this gets effective corrections, or if one goes to smaller and smaller scale, there will be deviations. That also enters on a Hamiltonian first, and then if we compute as before the effective Hamiltonian by computing the expectation value, then this will also appear in these perturbation equations that change their coefficients. So that is a second issue related to that Hamiltonian, also the gravitational form of Hamiltonian, that needs to be taken into account, and that would modify perturbation equations and could lead to observable effects. But that's also being brought out, and I don't have time anymore, so I conclude. And many of the difficulties in quantum gravity or quantum physics can be avoided by using effective techniques. And what I show is one example, but it's a general framework, and one particular example, which here gives a theory of structure generation that contains a metric on the classical modes, but also quantum fluctuation terms, and describes the whole coupling between them. As potential observable effects, I mentioned the amplitude of the spectrum, correlations or non-Gaussianities, which would occur already at this linearized level here, and possibly this reduction of odd modes. And as we discussed, and probably still discuss, there are also relations to interpretational issues, because one can just describe the quantum system by this kind of approximation without having to pick any particular mechanism to describe the collapse of the wave function, or something that is usually used to describe the transition between quantum and classical physics. And finally, which I just remarked briefly, there are also these quantum gravity corrections, which, what I just mentioned, modified coefficients from inverse powers of metric operators. But one also expects higher order and higher derivative terms, which change the equations considerably. So that also is being worked out now. And so, and at least on smaller scale, this will be on top of these quantum fluctuation terms, and also favorable, possibly, observations. OK, thank you.
Can you go to the third or fourth slide that you had, where you describe quantum mechanics, quantum theory, even before that?
That's just a matter of field.
Yeah, the next, where you define commutate, quantum Hamiltonian quantum theory. Yeah. Whoops. Before this, actually, about two slides. Yeah, that's right. Now, the way you wrote that down, psi is equal to, I'm looking at the last slide, those C's are dimensionless, because psi has the same dimensions and the same sign.
Yeah.
So then the equation at the bottom is wrong. You can't take commutator or anti-commutator of two-dimensionless numbers and get an h-bar. So you must mean something different.
Yeah, I guess I don't mean that. I don't mean something different, because I took it from a paper. And on that paper meant something different. Poisson brackets also have dimensions, because they have derivatives by q and p. In the classical case.
Yeah, no, so I agree with you, but not with this definition of C's. I mean, your C's are dimensionless, so that C squared is a probability, which is also dimensionless.
Right.
But then you can't multiply. So subtract two dimensionless numbers and suddenly get one over Planck's constant. So
yeah.
You must have some other equations.
Yeah, I guess one has one. One could just take a constant in here to end definition.
Yeah, it's not clear. I mean, I have trouble visualizing the whole system, how you can have both classical variables and quantum variables, so you try to explain it to me.
In this case, they are just these coefficients. Right? So to do that, we have to go to the other set of variables. And so it's, and basically, you want to describe the wave function by some set of coordinates, so you and then it's known from mathematical theorem that you can just describe a wave function or any function uniquely by just giving the expectation values and all these higher moments, which are expectation values of higher powers of the operator. So we just do that. We take the expectation values of Q and P and we take higher powers. And we just call these expectation values classical variables. Well, that will be related to the classical variables in the H property on limit.
Yeah.
So it's probably just the notation here that is that
makes
it really confusing.
Okay. Next question. Before I call an answer.
Yeah. And I thought you got non-Gaussian even before considering an isotropy, just from not being in the grand station. So there's always an issue. You have something which looks like a harmonic oscillator. The ground state is Gaussian.
Yeah,
for it's only the origin of Gaussian. So every time you go beyond that, you will get like these Hermite polynomials and wave functions. Things will be more complicated anyway. So I was just wondering if that's connected with this, you know, even before.
You could just start in a ground state, so you can specify your state by specifying initial conditions for the quantum variables.
Yeah.
And it's more general as long as you leave it unspecified. And you can make it more complicated by choosing general addition values.
So you could go off the ground state?
Yes.
Okay, so, what we measure on the sky, statistics is related to the variance of the probability distribution of the curvature perturbation. When the wavelength is, you know, much larger than the Hubble range and so on. It's related to the variance of the probability distribution of classical perturbations. Now, I don't see you getting a probability distribution for classical perturbations. You've just got one perturbation that is determined by some quantum, whatever going on, quantum early in the universe. So how can you talk about correlations, non-Gaussianity? You don't have a probability distribution.
When you really specify the initial state completely, you get a distribution. But for that, you need to know all the initial values for the quantum variables.
Fair enough. But are you saying you haven't yet calculated? I mean, is the distribution going to be approximately Gaussian? Is it going to be anything like? I mean, you're talking about comparing your observation. You can only compare your observation once you've got that distribution.
Right. Yeah, you can choose the distribution around these around the initial Gaussian states. Right. And you have to pick initial condition for the quantum variable to solve all these equations. So they are all, and there is infinitely many equations for infinitely many variables. And if your theory doesn't give you a unique initial state, you need to assume something which you would usually do by picking at least a distribution for your initial states.
So
that's
not
like picking a classical distribution. It's not a
so that's where the distribution will come from. It will come from a distribution over initial quantum state,
right?
Which you haven't considered yet.
Right.
Oh.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Last question.
I think you related that. And yeah, I think it's a little bit unfair that the party line on the fluctuations as copied this Newton out would include both quantization and the metric in the sense that the field that's being quantized includes the metric mode. And if the dual background field expansion like you're doing here with your classical variables, but the quantum classical transition in the party line would have been that you're only really following specific kinds of modes that are kind of at the scale of the Hubble scale, you know, some range of time. And there's a lot of other ones you're not following. So then the idea is that in the usual way you do in the lab, you're tracing over a bunch of variables that you're not, that you never measure. And that trace process can take you from a pure state to a mixed state. And the claim is that you can take it to a density, which is describing a classical ensemble where you're being the same. And so that presumably is going to happen to you too, because some of what's coming is because you're coupled to the environment and you have to follow that. But in principle,
yeah, we still need to do the truncation. Divide those two. Let's go be similar to just pricing over. But I mean, it may be the same system. I mean, it is definitely the same system that we're describing. It's just a different formalism, and there may be effects like fields that are just simpler to see in one formulation than in others.
Because this is not a quantum classical transition in the sense that in the usual way you would mean it if you're right. Right on the lab, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the part line way really is. It's a pure mixed state, and you know why you get that transition. It's pure mixed state. And the density matrix you get, which is giving you a probability distribution, has a very specific effect.
I think it would be similar here, because you would start initially with all these fluctuation terms, because these would be the only inhomogeneous ones, the only non-zero modes. So then, after some time, some evolution, the classical inhomogeneities grow, and at this time you can ignore most of the fluctuations, which is like just pressing over them. Even though we don't describe it as a pure mixed state, it's I think it's physically it's probably related.
Well, the standard one, I'm sure you could describe the standard one in this formula. So you have, but what you're describing in your talk is not that, right? It's like you're talking about the evolution of the expectation value as a function of correlations.
Yeah, if we keep all these terms all the time, then we would know we know tracing over anything. But for any explicit application, you have to use a kind of foundation. And at this stage, I think something similar would come in if we do that explicitly, as we did it in this Hamiltonian oscillator. Except that here, there are much more explicit because it's classically already a field theory, so we have many more quantum fluctuation and correlation that we need to ignore if we want to get any end of the system of operations.
Okay. Thank you. Martin is here for the and it's giving